You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Jenny Wood is a former executive at Google who ran a large operations team that helped drive billions of revenue per year. She is the founder of Own Your Career, one of the largest career development programs in Google's history. Her writing has been featured in Harvard Business Review, Entrepreneur, Inc., and Forbes. She's got a terrific new book. It's called Wild Courage. Go after what you want and get it. Enjoy the pod.
Counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jenny Wood, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. It is super duper cool to be here.
Okay. Weird, selfish, shameless, obsessed, nosy, manipulative, brutal, reckless, bossy. These are not attributes that one would normally apply to life and work success, and yet they are the nine concepts in the nine chapters of your book that you encourage individuals to embrace to achieve what they want to achieve. And from my reading of the book, it seems like you want to challenge your readers to do a reframe on how they are walking through the world. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I want to reclaim these bars that create the invisible cage that keeps you small.
All right. And so when did you know? when did you know that you had this different vibe on the world that might end up in a business book, or if that's what this is?
Yeah, it's business, professional development, personal development. I was given a homework assignment on a flight back from Chicago when I was meeting with my literary, flight back from New York, meeting with my literary agent, and one of my editors. And it was the first time we'd met the three of us together in person. And one of my editors gave me this homework assignment that on the flight back, write up a list of all the things you do that have helped you achieve outsized success in life that could have a bit of an ick factor. Mm. And I was like, huh. Interesting assignment. I ended up writing 14 pages pretty damn easily, Kelly. It rolled off my fingertips. But it was minor things. It was things like when I first started working with the two of you, I was so insecure about my status as an author because, you know, I work with one of the top literary agents in New York City. She has all the stars. And I was like, who am I? Like, I can't believe you even took me on as a client. And so I wrote a handwritten note, really like heartfelt, thoughtful, long. Who writes a handwritten note anymore? Sent it to her. Same thing with my editor. And I said, I put this in the document as something that could have a bit of an ick factor because I admitted in this set of notes I was writing that I had an ulterior motive. And yes, I wanted to show them they were valued and that I appreciated their partnership, but I also was trying to tip the scales in my favor a little bit, that they would care about me or know that I was worth working with, or if I couldn't match other authors and their fame and their audience size, I could at least offer, you know, good collaboration and a friendly demeanor. And so I really was trying to, what we ended up calling in the book, manipulate the situation a little bit, manipulate the partnership and tip the scales in my favor so that they would work really hard for me. And so it was things like that, that it seemed innocuous, but I really did feel like, no, this was intentional. This was by design. I was trying to achieve a specific goal here of partnership.
It's interesting. We mentioned before we started taping that I just came from a conversation. It was the first in-person meeting, which I think will be the group that will write the follow-up, the Yes And, which is exciting. And we got to this place where we were working on what the chapters might look like. And first it was sort of like, well, what's the case study? And then it's like, what's the phenomenon? And then at a certain point, we were like, what is the thing we want, we know that people need help with in the world? And maybe that's a play. And so I think it's a similar process we all go through where it's like, we're being a bit reductive on purpose, but we're trying to get to that nugget of like, what's going to connect so that you listen to a little bit of this and you're going to keep going?
Well, exactly. And what's really poignant to me of what you just said is, what's the thing that people need in the world? And the natural pushback on these 9 traits would be selfish. Don't we need less selfishness in the world? Don't we need people to be less brutal and less manipulative? But no, I would argue that if you think about right now, 10 people who you know in your circle, your professional circle, your social circle, I would argue that of those 10 people, many more of them need help overcoming their imposter syndrome, overcoming their insecurities, standing up for themselves more, right? Being selfish, or owning their talents and their strengths and confidently going after they want. Let's call that shameless. I would argue that many people need to dial it up versus the very, very few that need to dial it back, who truly are the bad kind of selfish, manipulative, or brutal.
And they're not reading this book anyway.
So F them.
Yes, or my book. All right. So you start the book with the story of how you met your husband, which I think actually also is a great framing. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it's 2011, New York City. I'm riding a dirty, crowded C line home from work. And about 20 feet away from me stands this really good-looking guy. Gorgeous blue eyes, brown wavy hair, the whole works. And while I want to talk to him, there are no social norms around approaching somebody and talking to them on a subway. You just don't. So I'm sitting there not taking any action. And I say, all right, well, maybe if he gets off at my stop, 72nd Street, that's the universe telling me it was meant to be. And I'll try to strike up a conversation with him. And if not, say lovey. So he gets off at the next stop, 59th Street. And I like slump down in my seat and I'm like, okay, well, I guess fate wasn't on my side today. And then just as the doors are about to close, this wave of wild courage like washes over me and practically pushes me out of my seat and off the train as I really all but pry those doors open. Mm-hmm. And I catch up with him as he's exiting the station. I tap him on the shoulder and I say, excuse me, you're wearing gloves, so I can't tell if you're wearing a wedding ring. But in the event that you're not married, you were on my subway and I thought you were cute. Any chance I could give you my business card? And then I wait for what feels like forever and see no response from him initially, thinking, oh, this was a terrible idea. But then finally, he takes the card. And as he takes the card, I remember thinking, screw the universe, I was saying, had, you know, the ability to make this meant to be. Like, I'm making my own meant to be. I am using my own wild courage to chase after what I want in life. 3 years later, we got married. We've now been married happily 11 years with 2 little hooligans, ages 7 and 9.
Oh, that's awesome. So chapter one's called Weird. And I thought about this because the very first time I did a TEDx, I tell the story. I'm talking about opening story about my son taking improv classes. And I have a line in there where I say, he has weird theater parents, so he's a weird theater kid.
Oh, I love it.
And you say that, quote, my attributes have always been strengths or weaknesses, depending on the context and how well I've leveraged them. That's important. Because it is, and it's true throughout the book, which things are not one way or the other. They exist in a context, and it depends how you're using them in a moment. And I think for people who are certainly in the parlance of improvising, when they're improvising wisely, they know when to dial it up and to dial it down.
Sure.
And I think you're right. Most people dial down.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so let's talk about good weird and concerning weird, or not concerning weird, but you know, I, with all these 9 traits, I also offer trait traps, which is when you take the trait too far and when that strength can become the shadow side, or exactly what you just read, like, you know, could be good or bad depending on the context. So good weird, you know, let's say you want to stand out at work. There's an award that my team was up for. You could fill out the boring, dry document with all of the details about the customer impact and whatever it was. But I decided my team should make a music video and that should be how we try to win this award. So like, that's the kind of standout, be bold, You know, leverage your talents, do something that's memorable, right? Even if you get your wrist slapped for saying something that maybe slightly dissents with the leadership, at least it's memorable and you're seen as leadership because leadership needs to have a strong opinion and you can always course correct. So like that's good, weird, is standing out in that way. Or if you're the intern in a new role, speak up. Don't just nod along like a bobblehead, right? Come off of mute, share an idea, offer a suggestion. I've got 6 interns working on this book and we had our publishing meeting yesterday and 2 boldly came off of mute and shared really good ideas while 4 of them just nodded along. Guess who I'm going to remember? The 2 weird ones who had the courage to say something. So like that's how we want to be quote unquote weird. But here's a bad context or bad example. 7th grade, I'm nervous as heck, brand new to the school. I go into language arts class. The teacher gives her little intro spiel and asks, does anybody have any questions? And I raise my hand, desperate for a laugh. And I say, I have a question. Are you a virgin? Right? That's not the weird we're going for. We're not looking to just say something outlandish or offensive for attention or for any kind of, you know, relationship gain, which obviously worked in the opposite direction that day.
I don't know if you know this about improv, but one of the things that it is so known for, especially in sort of the beginning classes, is getting you comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yes.
Because you have no script. And right. You don't know what the other person is going to say. So you have to be in that state of, I'm going to accept whatever it is, and I'm going to build on it, and we're going to explore, yep. And we're going to heighten together. It's not comfortable. And that comes across in this book pretty dramatically, and I'm sure. Glad it does, especially now, because it's gotten worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So, by the way, I love that. I love being on the show because I love talking improv. I helped lead our improv group in the Google Boulder office.
Of course you did.
That is
not
a fun
shocking
fact.
At all.
That is nowhere online in bio. Oh, maybe it does say something in one of my bios about being an improv lover/student. But yes, no, it absolutely is about being comfortable, getting uncomfortable. And that's basically what this book is, right? Like it goes back to those 10 people that you think about. Chances are they need to dial it up more than they need to dial it back because the vast majority of us struggle with a fear of failure. Fear of unknown, fear of uncertainty, fear of judgment of others. And by the time I started writing this book, I had coached tens of thousands of Google executives, non-Googlers, artists, entrepreneurs, creatives, you know, inside and outside of the company, directly or indirectly, on success and leadership and chasing after what they want. And the theme that came up was their relationship to fear. Like that was the thread. And wild courage is the process of feeling that fear and taking action anyway. It's the set of tools to go after what you want and get it. And I mean, you're absolutely right that all starts with discomfort because if you're comfortable, you're not scared and there's no fear. And if you're uncomfortable, that fear exists, but that's what I want you to push through to the joy and success waiting for you on the other side, because everything good comes on the other side of fear.
This is a thing we were discussing here vis-a-vis the comedy theater I work at, sure. And doing political satire right now, because mm-hmm. It's not that easy. Yeah. And one of the things that my wife is this is her field. She's a comedy professor. And mm-hmm. She talks about the fact that, you know, for satire, it's most effective usually in times of great comfort, because you're able then to take shots at powerful figures. And then,
sure.
And in a place right now where everything's so topsy-turvy, it's really difficult to negotiate that.
It is.
However, this ability, and Ethan Cross has a book about this, about shifting, the idea that you can shift through your emotions. And it's not about avoiding them. At times it is. That's fine. But it's that ability to move from one to another, and you're going to make mistakes.
Oh,
they
yes.
are inevitable. And if you know that, you're going to be able to incorporate those into your own personal narrative so that you can try something new.
It is a shift. I was talking about this with my therapist this morning, right? Like I was a corporate executive. I grew from entry level to senior leader at Google in 18 years. That was an awesome life. And now I took this massive risk. I got a little reckless and I erred on the side of action and took a calculated risk. And I'm now an entrepreneur and it is hard. It is super, super, super hard. And so what I was talking about in therapy today was, you know, I have 300 or so people who've gotten the advanced reader copy of the book. And the intention for those people aside from media is to bring me in for keynote speaking or to, you know, buy the book in bulk. And that takes follow-up, that takes asking, that takes pushing past my own fear of rejection and uncertainty and failure and, you know, how people might judge me or like how pushy or not pushy I am about it. And basically like selling and kind of semi cold pitching. And so I'd gotten through about 200 of these follow-ups and, you know, it's been a while since I've been in sales and I forgot that the number of no's you need to get to yes is pretty imbalanced. And so when I realized I wasn't having 100% success rate with the first 200, I just got so down on myself. And I was saying this morning, like, gosh, it's been so hard to send out that last final 100. But it's because it's so uncomfortable and it's uncomfortable to hear no. And it's hard to push through it. But like, that's where the success lies is that shift of like, it is hard and I need to do it anyway. It's a pretty small shift, but it sometimes feels really big.
Yeah. I'm glad you talked about no. I'm obsessed with it, having written the book, Yes And.
Yeah.
And we had Dr. Sunita Saw on the podcast who wrote a book called Defy, which is all about why we don't say no. Mm-hmm. And this is in your chapter 2 on selfish. Mm-hmm. And you're in a freezing lift on the way to the airport.
Oh, yeah.
You were not going to ask him to turn the heat on.
Yeah. So, and this is all about, I mean, I love this example because it is about how we wait for permission from others to do what we want or what we need or what makes us comfortable. And we rarely give permission to ourselves before we have that external permission. So the situation is, I'm on the way to the airport. I'm freezing cold, but I'm like, it's this guy's car. I don't want him to be too hot. I'm always cold. My husband's always telling me, put on a sweatshirt, right? Mm-hmm. And so I hated the idea of making him uncomfortable. This is like bold, courageous Jenny didn't want to make the Lyft driver uncomfortable. And then I noticed this glorious little placard on the back of the seat that says, need something? Water? Charger? Air conditioning? Heat? And I was like, that lovely, beautiful man, he's so generous. And then finally, when I had permission with that little placard on the back, I said, is it possible to turn up the heat? No problem. But it's like, why couldn't I have just been selfish in the best possible way, right? Selfish is the courage to stand up for what you want. It's about being your own champion. You know, give everyone else a leg up at your expense and you'll end up getting trampled. Start showing up for yourself. But in that moment, I couldn't even show up for myself in that little teeny tiny little thing that I wanted, which was a warm ride that I was paying for. And it's tough. And some, you know, and I consider myself someone who is pretty comfortable asking for what she wants. And even that's an example that just reminded me that like this stuff can be really hard and that it's okay to be selfish in the right ways. You're not harming anyone. You can expand the pie, not necessarily slice it up.
So the science is kind of interesting on this. So there's been some studies, Vanessa Bonza Cornell, and I think she might be working on a full book on this. But the idea that when you need a boundary paid attention to, when you need a no, it is great to be given a script. That is an allowance. And you were given a script. It was a sign.
Exactly.
That's a script.
Yeah, it was a script. It literally said, need something? Ask for it. And then I did. But I didn't until the script.
And it is different from the sort of yes and, which is about iterative creativity that we're doing sort of together in these spaces. We're not always in these spaces. Sometimes we just need you to leave me alone, you know, or whatever. And so I'm very conscious now, especially in any status situation where I've got more status than someone else, to say to them, I want to make sure you know you can say Kelly no. That's totally fine. And a lot of times people will say yes anyway. That's fine, but they have that. And that makes me feel better because it gives agency to them.
Oh yeah. Well, it's also you being a great leader. I mean, this is something I cover in Bossy, the courage to listen and lead. And it also is giving people who might be perceived as less status than you the permission that they might need, going back to sometimes people need permission to ask for what they want. And so that is just a fantastic leadership skill that you're employing there.
Chapter 3 is called Shameless. And I love this passage. You say, quote, when you keep your bag packed, literally or metaphorically, you limit your performance. You can't do your best work when you're convinced that you don't belong, that some authority will deem you unworthy and force you out, end quote. Talk more about that.
Yeah. So I had this colleague at Google who kept this nylon gray backpack under her desk and never took it to the gym, never unpacked it. And finally I said, what's in the backpack? And she said, oh, you know, picture frames and knickknacks for my desk. And she said, but I have to confess, Jenny, I'm so so scared that someone's going to realize their mistake in hiring me that I can't bring myself to unpack my bag. And that's, you know, why I say when you keep it packed, literally or more metaphorically, you are limiting your potential. You're limiting your creativity. But think about that. How often do you keep your backpack packed? How often do you not fully display your talents and your skills and your knickknacks and your framed pictures, just confidently knowing that you should be doing this podcast or doing this job or leading in this way or producing this show or, you know, being an entrepreneur or asking those 100 people if they'll bring me in for a keynote, right? It is something we all do. And we know imposter syndrome is rampant. And mm-hmm. It really just means that you're surrounding yourself by smart, you know, impressive, talented people, and that you've probably made it in life because you've reached a point where, like, you're not surrounded by a bunch of dummies. You're surrounded by a bunch of awesome people who challenge you. And that's a good thing.
So I got a funny thing that's kind of the other side of the backpack. Yeah. Sunil Gupta, great friend, wrote a fantastic book called Backable. And he tells a story about a primatologist in the 50s in Africa who was renowned for the ability to get closer to the primates than anyone else. And he was at a conference and a woman raised her hand, goes, you know, how do you do that? And he goes, oh, it's easy. I don't carry a gun in my backpack.
Huh. Interesting.
And the idea being they know. They know if you have a gun. They know if you don't have a gun.
Oh, yeah. Well, I call this insecure vibes, right? Like, yes. You can really give off insecure vibes. And so, like, I mean, shameless is find your swagger. Audacity or shamelessness is a survival skill. And so how will you learn whether you've got the goods if you don't act like it first? So at least first start acting like you belong there by unpacking the bag and putting the knickknacks on the desk, whatever that means for you metaphorically.
So chapter 4 is Obsessed, and this feels like maybe the most Second City improv chapter for a number of reasons.
Oh, I'm so curious why.
Okay, so first is this idea that we talk about constantly, which is we don't practice this stuff. That in every, at Second City before, we do rehearsals. Of course we do.
Sure.
For symphony orchestras, they also do rehearsals. Before Major League Baseball games, they play catch.
Sure.
Yo-Yo Ma does scales. And you go to a gym and you don't go once and you game over.
Yeah.
And you say work should be a workout. The only way to get stronger at the gym is to do more reps and choose a heavier dumbbell. Sticking with the same effort every time won't build your muscles. Life is like that. Work is like that. And because work is so built on communication, how are you practicing your communication skills? Most people don't.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I have a tool for this specifically called Tame the Octopus. Mm-hmm. Can we do a little role play?
Love it.
Because I do think that if there's one thing to choose to be obsessed about as you grow in your career or in life, it is communication. And that can be written communication. This tool is for verbal communication. So let's say we're in a meeting. This is a tool to ramble less. Let's say we're in a meeting. I'm going to do this two ways. Could you just ask me, pretend you're my boss, and you say, Jenny, yeah. What are your biggest Q2 challenges? I'll do it two ways. First, the bad way, then the good way.
Jenny, what are your biggest Q2 challenges?
Oh my gosh, there's so much going on for my team right now. You know, we're a brand new team. We're kind of experimental. So we've got all these priorities we've got to sort through and what's important, what's not important, which reminds me that like one of the important things we're thinking through is the tooling on the team and what's through an API, what's through a spreadsheet, what's external, what's internal. And speaking of all of that, like we've got all these teams that are across the world. We've got teams in Americas and Europe and Asia. And it's really hard to collaborate across time zones. You know, you get it. You've heard that rambling answer.
Turned out like an hour ago.
Exactly. Yeah. You tuned out for an hour ago and you turned it out an hour ago. So let's try it again where you ask the same question, Jenny, what are your team's biggest Q2 challenges? And I'm going to tame the octopus, meaning that answer had a lot of tentacles. It was going in a lot of different directions and an octopus cannot swim quickly when it's all over the place, you know, in a tangled mess. When we tame the octopus, we bring those tentacles in and boom, we can shoot from one place to the next, from point A to point B much faster. So the question again is, Jenny, what are your team's biggest Q2 challenges?
Jenny, what are your team's biggest Q2 challenges?
Right, let me think about that for just a moment. Okay, for those listening, I am writing down on a piece of paper some of the things that might come to mind. My team's biggest Q2 challenges are number one, priorities, number two, tools, and number three, global alignment. Priorities, because we're a new team and we have to figure out the important versus the unimportant. Tools, because we need to streamline what's done internally versus externally. And global alignment, since we sit across Americas, Europe, and Asia, we need to work in concert with each other, not against each other. So my three biggest challenges are priorities, tools, and global alignment. So what did I do there?
Well, my favorite, here's my favorite thing you did.
Yeah.
Is you had the huge pause, which was not uncomfortable, made me think you were thinking about it, and I was appreciative for it.
There you go. And by the way, we did that on a podcast where people, where we knew that some people were listening and might be thinking, is this thing on? Right?
Like, that's right.
I mean, to be fair, I cheated a little bit. I guess I got a little bit uncomfortable and I felt like I did have to. This shows how hard a pause is. I did feel like I had to take care of the listener a little bit and say, I'm writing things down, by the way. So I wasn't as comfortable in the pause as I should have been. So that's my own critical feedback to myself. But that's what I did. The most important thing I did there was I took a pause. We feel self-conscious or insecure or like we're going to sound stupid if we take a pause, when in reality, we sound more confident and more poised and more buttoned up. And like you said, like I'm honoring the question and actually being thoughtful about my answer. So that's the first step, was I took the pause. The second step is I wrote down maybe 7 or 8 things I could have talked about. Because things are always going to come to your mind. You want thinking to happen on the paper, not out loud. I circled 3 that felt the most relevant. And then when I started talking, I said just those 3 things first. Priorities, tools, global alignment. And then I buttoned up the answer at the end, repeating, you know, I said the things, I went into them a little bit each, then I repeated them at the end. And it's like, you think you can't do this in an interview or in a one-on-one with your boss's boss or in a team meeting. But you so can. In fact, with all the virtual meetings, if you get a doozy of a question like that that could go in a million different directions, you can do all that thinking and prep work before you even press the raise hand button and come off of mute, right? And even if you are on the spot and you feel like you have to answer right away and it's just you and the other person, you can still take that time to pause, button up your answer, and then start speaking it.
Can I make you play an improv game with me?
I am so pumped you just said that.
All right, we're gonna play a game called Last Word.
Okay.
And there's one simple rule, is that for both of us, the first word of our response to the thing that the other person said has to start with the last word that they said.
Fabulous.
It's very simple. I'll start. Jenny, I really enjoyed the book, and one of the things that I mentioned to you, which is, you're the queen of the sort of the one-liner. And I think the sort of pithy one-liner is a skill that not everyone has.
Has is an interesting way to think about it, because when we think about what we have and what we don't have, it makes me think about the audience that's reading this book and what they'll think they have of these 9 traits, what they'll think they don't have, and what they want to have more of that will help them be more successful.
Successful is key. And you just pointed out, because this idea is they think you're either born with it or you aren't. Mm. That these people have magic. They think that about these Second City people all the time. Like, what you don't realize is they walked in as mediocre as everyone, but they put their attention and their practice and their focus on being good and making their partners look good. And that is what makes a great improviser.
Improvisers excel when they're good listeners and when they're focused on the other. And that's why listening is so critical to good improv, because it's about responding with no agenda, just being in the moment, taking the situation as it comes. This is what I call reckless in the book, and erring on the side of action and taking a calculated risk. It is so risky to be up there on the stage with no preparation, no practice, no idea what might come up, and to take a giant risk.
All right. And scene. All right. So here's what I liked about it.
Yeah.
And I want your observation as well. Sure. Here's what I noticed.
Yeah.
You took your time to listen all the way to the end of the sentence, a thing we don't do. Mm-hmm. So you really, in that, you wanted to get to the gist of what was important, what I said, and you took it. You took that like the has, what does the has mean? And you went right to that thing that's much more interesting than what the pat response would be, which is, what do you think you have? Because I bet that is down there, and it could become a have, even if you think it's not there. So I felt like it got deeper. I'm curious what you sort of discovered doing the exercise.
Okay, so I discovered something that is very nuanced for recording a podcast, but I have trained myself to look in the camera as opposed to the host. So for most of this podcast, I'm actually and I'm like giving you, you know, inside baseball here.
I love it.
But I'm actually, it's been a really hard habit to break. But like, to me, eye contact is eye contact with the audience if they're watching this on video. And so, but I found myself in the first couple of iterations of that exercise losing so much by looking into the camera, which was not directly at you. And then once I shifted to looking at you, I was able to take in your body language. I was able to retain much more the gist of what the, of what you were, you know, what insight you were adding to the conversation. And so it relates to manipulative, like being manipulative in a good way, right? This is about building influence through empathy. And, you know, whether you're selling a product, an idea, yourself, the ability to win friends, allies, and supporters is all about mutual benefit. Figure out what people want and go get it for them. You can't do that if you don't have empathy. And I found myself lacking that empathy because I wasn't looking directly at you and wasn't retaining as much as I could have. Had I been looking directly at you, once I made that shift to look at you, I was really in a good spot to feel that empathy and to like really deeply feel where you were taking the conversation. And the tool there, you know, you can take away is like the importance of body language, the importance of gestures, the importance of micro moments in a face that you can get only when deeply connecting with someone in a relationship, a conversation, a negotiation, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. This came up in this conversation about the follow-up DSN book. And my friend Dave offered something today where he said, really, it's about being human better rather than being a better human.
Oh, I love that.
Me too, because I'm so like, good. I can't make you a better human, but I can make you better at being, you know, a human. You can make a human better. And that is a different, thing. And I think so many of us think that we can do that, like that reading the book will solve the thing. And you say this in the book too. It's like, that's the knowledge exchange is not the thing. It's right. It's these practices that you can take out into the world and try them. And some of them are going to work and some of them aren't. You need a big toolbox.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Chapter 5 is nosy. And you say, if I had to point to one skill that's gotten me where I am today, it's curiosity. And curiosity is a skill. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, first, this is like such an improv tool, but open-ended questions, what and how questions over yes or no questions. Let's say I'm going to my boss and I want a raise. Rather than can I get a raise, perhaps try what might be possible in terms of, you know, my career growth here or my, or you could even be more explicit, what might be possible in terms of a raise. But, you know, nosiness is the courage to dig deeper. It's getting insatiably curious because curiosity drowns out fear and pulls you toward what is most exciting to you. And when you use it as a compass, you can uncover so much richness, even the richness in an answer that starts with what or how versus, versus a yes or no question is really, creating that insatiable curiosity, and it can be used in so many helpful ways at work.
I'm going to ask you for your yes and story in a moment, but before we do that, in the chapter 9, this is the bossy chapter. Mm-hmm. You talk about this mistake you made when you went into a new role at Google and you were leading this offsite meeting. And I don't know if you've heard this improv phrase. I want you to tell the story, but I want this improv phrase to stick with you, which is we say in our work, you need to bring a brick, not a cathedral.
Oh, I love that. Yes. Okay. So, well, I brought a cathedral that day.
Yeah,
and this is the first time I started managing managers at Google. And I was in a really senior leadership position where I was tasked with shutting down a department in one part of the world and building it back up in another. And I was insecure and nervous and had so much imposter syndrome. And I'm on this flight. This was the one where I'm flying back from Chicago. I'm like, which was New York.
All right.
I was confusing my flight stories.
That's a very nice bookend.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh my gosh, we've got this big offsite tomorrow where we have to decide the strategy and align pillars with people's talent. And I was like, well, I just need to show them that I know what's going on and that I know this business and that they made the right choice in hiring me for this role. You know, I'd been at Google a very long time already, but I was totally new to this organization. And I build this like amazing many, many, many slide deck. And I go into the conference room the next day with my senior leaders there around the table. And I plug in my laptop and I present my slides with so much leadership packed into this, 30 slide, you know, Google slide deck. And I start, you know, confidently presenting it like, this is Jenny as boss. They'll all believe now that I deserve to be here. It's like the opposite of the backpack story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I stopped presenting and there was silence and I was like, well, they're just taking it all in. And then you could have heard a erasable marker drop on the floor. And then someone said, like, Jenny, why would you come in here and think that you know more than we do? We have 35 combined years of leadership experience on this particular, in this particular department. You've been here, what, 3 months? And so at Google, we get rated on our leadership by our team below us. And I got like the equivalent of a D minus that quarter. And that was super hard. But the point was, like, what I needed to do was to just throw a bunch of Sharpies on the table, you know, say, here are some whiteboards and have at it and let them tell me, like, these are our strengths and this is what, these are what the pillars should be, operations and talent and process and, you know, culture, and let them decide where they wanted to align and what the timeline should be and what the Gantt chart should look like. And instead I'd done all the work for them. I'd built the cathedral rather than bringing some bricks to lay together to build it. And, you know, people need to weigh in to buy in. And I got nobody's buy in that day. And it was one of the biggest leadership mistakes I've made. I learned a lot from it, but it was grueling that day.
Yeah. There's a concept in improv that we call follow the follower, which we apply to leadership, which is at any given point, someone's going to have more information than you. You cannot be the person with every great idea. So at the time where you see that great idea, let them lead. And then they hand that back off to you. And then it goes to someone else in the team. And I remember we did this exercise for a leadership expert. He's like, you're doing Peter Drucker. And I'm like, who's Peter Drucker?
Sure.
Turns out this Viennese management theorist, he's the god of management theory. And he had this idea in the 1950s and was talking about then. And it's still in vanguard today. But it's, who taught you? Like, what was the manual you got when you set that position? I like, this is how you lead. Like, what kind of training did you go through for that?
To make that bad decision?
Yeah, or anything. The minute you go into these leadership positions, I don't find that training is very robust.
Yes, I agree. I mean, Google did have like incredible leadership training classes, but I guess I didn't attend them that day. I guess I was too busy cramming information into my slides. No, I mean, it was just insecurity that it was like, I have to prove myself. I have to prove that they made a good decision to bring me into this leadership role. And then I just made a really poor decision that day, but I learned from it. And thank goodness for their honesty. Like, that's a form of recklessness also.
Yeah.
You know, that's a calculated risk to stand up to the big boss and say, like, we got to scrap this plan and start over, Jenny. Like, that takes chutzpah, right?
Yeah,
that takes gall in the best way.
All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. I would not be surprised if you had many. But can you share one with us?
Yeah. The yes and for me is, I mean, I was like at the height of my career and the breadwinner for my family. And then this kind of the book was presented to me and I was like, how am I going to lead this huge program at Google that has grown to be one of the largest career programs of the company and lead my day job, which is not an easy job and you can't phone it in and also be a wife and a mom and think about doing all the stuff externally in this book. And so even though I never had any intention to write a book in my entire life, I said yes to the book. And then I left Google to do this full time, realizing that I couldn't do my Google job in 10% of my time. I didn't want to do this book in 10% of my time because it's just not the way I envisioned putting a big book out into the world. And there's enough money and, you know, talent and skill behind this book that I felt like I had to do right by the book to really do it full time, because a book is a whole endeavor, as you know. And so my yes was I'm going to write a book, and my and was I'm going to quit my Google exec role to do it full time, even if that makes me a starving artist.
I mean, I have a very similar story in terms of that. I had actually written, I wrote the book, then I quit,
okay,
which was very ill-advised. Two young kids at home. I mean, my wife, you know, works here too. So it was like, but it presented the opportunity that I tell you saved me. It opened up all the worlds of, I get to do this podcast. I work in academia. I get to go to these cool conferences.
Yeah.
And none of that would have happened if I stayed in the safety of my success.
Oh my gosh, I so want to quote you on that, or at the very least internalize it and think about it as I put my head on my pillow tonight. The safety of success. What a brilliant note to end this podcast on. Like, the safety of success. And yes, it would have been safe to stay at Google another 15 years and retire there, like I had always imagined. But the amount that I'm learning and failing and growing and the excitement and the exhilaration and the razzle dazzle that I'm enjoying is really, you know, it's just incredible. And it's a gift and it is damn hard, but I love it. And it's exciting. So thank you for that push.
The book is called Wild Courage. Go after what you want and get it. Jenny Wood, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.